Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I'm tired, but Jeff Carlin wants me to project from the diaphragm. Have some energy. But you know, I really don't feel energetic, and I don't feel like projecting. Thing is, I haven't slept. I tell you the truth about what goes on behind the scenes in the column, and I haven't slept for 2 days. It's not the election, it's not concern over the Republic. I've got sleep apnea. And that, if you know people who have it, my sleep apnea machine that lets me sleep is broken. I'm going through the bureaucracy of getting a new one. Just can't wait till we have government-controlled health care and I have to ask an alderman for my apnea machine. But even so, I'm clear-headed enough not to write a column, but I can talk to you. And one thing I've been thinking about is journalism. Is there any doubt now about journalism being neutral and how it covers politics? Is there any wonder if it's fair-minded? Ask yourself, where are the voices that pushed mail-in voting, which became a mess, and told you that anyone who complains about it is somehow wrong, evil, wants to suppress the voters? Where are they now? We can see journalists threatening to destroy those who question the election results. We have a list, says Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post. You should worry about your future employment, warned CNN's Jake Tapper. Is that how you heal a nation? By threats? Or is that how you light a spark that starts the fire? Threatening people, they don't sound like journalists. They sound like Chicago Way machine politicians. But they're journalists. And we'll see how Joe Biden is treated from now on. Let's see if he keeps getting the Obama treatment. We know he won't get the Trump treatment. He's a Democrat. The media protected Biden. You don't doubt that now, do you? Really? I mean, do you? I'm not talking about pundits. I'm a pundit. I'm an opinion columnist. I'm talking about the general political news, the newsrooms. The newsrooms that once thought, or at least told themselves, and anyone who cared to listen, like CNN's Chris Saliza says time and time again, for the billionth time, reporters don't root for a side, period. Do you believe that now? I don't even think Saliza believes it. And if he does, he's either a fool or he thinks you're a fool. So when did it go bad? When did American newsrooms, once full of iconoclasts, become woke? Woke as, let's say, Oberlin College. When did the woke newsrooms become full of political operatives, trying to cancel those who hold views they don't agree with? You could read great pieces on this from writers of the left who are worried about it, like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, who was forced to resign from The Intercept that he himself founded. Or you can read a superb piece from the right. National Review's Charles C.W. Cook takes down the media that campaigned avidly for Joe Biden. I say, read them all. And if you're interested, stick around and listen to today's guest, my friend, colleague, valued editor, John McCormick, a son of Iowa, an old school Chicago newspaper man, and longtime editor of the Chicago Tribune's editorial page. The same position now held by our mutual friend, Kristen McQueary. I remember talking about the media with McCormick years ago, and he offered up a lead that I should use at the beginning of a column. I didn't, but I should have. It was a short 6-word sentence. I am worried about the craft. And so is he. There are many great reporters, good reporters, hard-working reporters, straight shooters who bring you the news. They cover the crime, they bond court, they cover the federal building, the local politics, the real estate, local arts, schools, coronavirus lockdowns. But Washington political reporting, the land of the Beltway Kamalists protecting the turf, their team against the people. It's my opinion, but media has become the auxiliary of the Democratic Party. And big tech has slid its greasy silicon thumbs on the scale. It is a craft. But when did it flip? When did the iconoclasts become the palace guardians of big government and big corporate and big tech? I think back to the Obama years. The woke flocked to him like wiggly puppies about to soil the carpet. Yes, he was our first black president. And yes, a brilliant orator. And yes, an outstanding communicator. He was a historic figure in our politics. But he was idolized. They crowned him as a reformer. They lauded him for a Nobel Prize, even though he had only been in office for weeks. They ignored Obama's Chicago Way connections, ignored how he buttressed the corrupt Daily Machine in Chicago, and installed Rahm Emanuel as mayor in that bait-and-switch nonsense on the Charlie Rose Show. Obama foreign policy advisor Ben Rhodes mocked them all, mocked journalists, as easily manipulated, quote, 27-year-old know-nothings on that Iran deal, the Iran nuclear deal. And rather than step back and reflect about how even Ben Rhodes would mock them, they doubled down in 2016 and began to carry water for that Russia collusion story. Their Russia collusion story was a hoax, and they didn't seem to care that they'd been manipulated. What bothered me is they didn't want to walk the cat back. People on the left shrieked at me for worrying about the federal intelligence and the FBI used to pull off a Chicago Way takedown, but I was horrified and still am. That they don't see that if we allow the intelligence agencies to take down a politician you don't like, well, they could do it to those politicians you like and to you. We'll talk about this with Mr. McCormick, and he'll push back when he thinks I go too far, just as he always did, and I welcome it. And that's what I like about him. And Jeff Carlin is here, but then he's always here. Without him, I wouldn't do this. I couldn't. Jeff is the best radio producer in the business, and he's the executive producer on WGN Radio. And me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, a member of its editorial board. And where are you? With journalists talking about we have a list to shame or ruin those who dare question them. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
If you're going to talk about the future of journalism, you have to talk to a journalist. And we have one here in John McCormick, the former longtime editor of the Chicago Tribune's editorial page. He worked previous to that at Newsweek and other publications. There have only been a few in that spot that he's in now. We could go to John McCutcheon, to Jack Fuller, to Don Wycliffe, to Lois Willey, to Bruce Dold, to John McCormick, who recently and graciously handed off that task to Kristen McQuarrie, she of the lovely voice who can sing in Cleveland. And I'll never forget that singing. Good day to you, John McCormick.
Good morning, John.
The idea here, and I'm really thrilled that you're here, the idea is to talk about the future of journalism, especially now, 2020, tribalism, bubbles. We write for ourselves and for all those who want to see themselves reflected in the mirror that they've chosen, not to be challenged by ideas that may run counter to their tribal cant. And I wonder, is there a future for that?
There is a future. I don't know whether it'll be, you know, we've been tossing around the word trust a lot in the last few weeks. You know, do you trust this? Do you trust that? But, you know, those of us who do it for a living, you know, we come into people's homes. Hopefully we're at least a little bit pleasant, and hopefully we're straightforward, and hopefully we tell the truth and they trust us. When any of that breaks down, then, you know, we've abrogated the contract, right?
I guess.
If you're a dour, lying presence, why exactly am I going to pay you money?
I forgot who said this. Maybe it was Charles Foster Kane, who said the business of newspapers is selling newspapers. And it looks like the business of news now, the news model has broken down. Generalist is replaced by the tribalist.
Yes.
If I'm a liberal, I have ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, et cetera, if I'm a conservative, I guess I go to Fox or Newsmax. If I'm a liberal reader, and I hope people read, I would go to the New York Times, perhaps the Chicago Tribune, perhaps many other newspapers. Or if I'm a conservative, I'll search out the National Review, the Federalist, and publications that reflect my views.
You'll probably look at the Wall Street Journal editorial page.
Of course.
Regionally, there are some papers that still fit that mold. You're right. The voices are there. But you asked really about an industry, John. And I mean, the industry is it's a craft. And I've never really thought it was a profession, but it's definitely a craft. And at what point do people, I mean, look at the number of people who've walked away already. You know, they feel they didn't quit one of these papers or networks you're citing. They feel that the network or the paper quit them.
I receive emails every day from people who are upset. Either they're upset with something I've written and they're going to cancel, or they're upset with something someone else has written and they're going to cancel. It almost feels like, as a former Democrat years ago, and still the Democrats say now, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party left me. And it's the same kind of thing in news. And I wonder, with technology, were adept at narrow casting to the point where the general, I guess, a general common understanding of events and parameters is we're losing that.
Mm-hmm.
And what that's what, and with social media, you know, magnifying the divide, it just bothers me and worries me. And if I can stop rambling for a second, John, just so listeners can know, John McCormick ran an excellent editorial page in which we'd sit around a table back when we actually met with each other, you know, before Zoom. And John would entertain all sorts of ideas from the left and the right and encourage debate. And Kristen does this as well. And it's a dignified setting, and it's uplifting, and it has nothing to do with the kind of mean-spirited attacks that I see on social media. And I just wish that everyone listening could be part of that kind of discussion. What happened to that kind of discussion generally in the country?
I don't know, but you're right. Those are some of the best times of my career, of my life, listening to those conversations. And I'm sure Kristen is such a pro. She is surely doing the same thing. I don't know. When did it become okay to put a thumb on the scale, particularly on the news side? You know, John, I would never, you know, having worked as an opinion journalist for 20 years, I'm in no position to complain about the people who are the designated writers of opinion, speakers of opinion in any news organization. You're one of them. Whether I'm turning my computer screen or my newspaper to you, I know I'm getting John Cass's outlook on life, the world according to Cass. Okay, that's fine. Same when I turn to, you know, a liberal columnist. Great, I know what I'm getting. You know, it's transparent. I'm not at the Buick dealership where someone's trying to sell me a Toyota because they think I should have one. And you know, the simple analogy that's always been in the back of my mind on this, John, is that, you know, the people. I mean, you want all kinds of people at an, I'm going to say newspaper, but every time you and I say that, we mean big news organization. The biggest news organizations tend to be newspapers. There's room at the newspaper for two kinds of people. One is the little boy or girl who grew up running in the house, hollering to the rest of the family, "Hey, guess what just happened down the street? You know, a car hit the light pole." Okay, those are the people who, you know, belong in newsrooms. You have other little kids who run in the house, I suppose, and scream, "And here's what you have to think about it." Now, I would just as soon not have those people doing my news reporting. I want the little girl who comes in and says the car hit the light pole. I'm not so hot on the little boy who comes in and says, "Here's what you have to think about it." And I feel as a news consumer, and I have a pretty heavy one, that I'm in recent years, it has become okay to start off with telling me what I need to think about something. The simple notion of what happened or what is happening has become, I don't know if it doesn't serve individuals, you know, individual reporters' needs, but you know it when you see it. You know, you're reading the lead on a story, and you can clearly tell that the person has interjected their characterization, their own opinion, into telling you that the car hit the light pole. I find it off-putting, and that's why I worry about our future, because when people walk away, I mean, there's nothing easier for a reader to do than turn the page. Nothing easier for a viewer to do than click the off button. Our audiences have shrunk. There's just, how do we stop the audiences from shrinking, John?
When I see certain phrases in I'm separating news from opinion, okay? Let's look at just news. There are certain attitudes that come, it's sort of edgier, sell. There are more attitude comes in with it. There's not the old Dean Reynolds approach to it. There's more of an edgy attitude. And I find I can see certain code words. For example, social justice. When I see that in the lead or in the headline, as a conservative, I'm like, why do I want to read this? This is going to lecture me. I'm going to be lectured about my failings as a human being. There are other code words. Can we just talk about social justice for a second? As an editor, you see that. Don't you want to say, what does that mean exactly? What are you saying? Where are you going with that word, with that phrase?
Well, John, you know, we've got folks listening, some of whom are, you know, some of whom don't share your sort of view of how attuned all of us should be to the social justice warriors about whom you occasionally write. But on a simple basis, you're right. That's the kind of phrase that an editor should say, whoop, 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 full stop. We need another couple of sentences here.
Correct.
What are we talking about here? I mean, I think, you know, you just said an important word there, editor. Not that editors are important, but that is the function, you know, of an editor to sort of, you know, one of the things that at the Tribune editorial board that's long been a coda there is that if you're an editor, we those of us who were editors used to talk about this. Yeah, you know, part of our job is to understand that we're working for the readers. We're not really working for the writers. It's the readers who pay our salary. It's the readers who support the Tribune and the New York Times and on and on and on. And any time you're sort of letting the writers run free, whether it's using obtuse language or interjecting unsupported opinion, you know, you're really letting the reader down. You may be letting the writer have her way, his way. And that's, you know, that's a failing. So the reason I go into this little monologue is, We've just been through an election cycle in which a lot of people got things wrong, got purported facts wrong. It follows 3 years of a Russia case in which a lot of people got a lot of things wrong. So I would hope, and I'm not going to get this for Christmas, but I would hope that two things would happen. First, the thing that should have happened by now on Russia is that the writers who were fed misinformation by anonymous sources, not anonymous to them, but anonymous to us readers, those sources should be outed. You know, the implicit contract between an anonymous source and a journalist is that I'm telling you the truth. John, you're the reporter. Mm-hmm. And if I'm misleading you intentionally, then you have no reason to protect me. You can write about me. Then we move up a line. That's sort of on a chart. That's sort of below the reporter, the information coming up to the reporter. But then above is the editor. What editors now get fired for permitting unverified information, poorly sourced information, to wind up, you know, in the public realm? Now, I just don't think I'm going to see too many editors fired. Do you?
That's been the astounding thing about all this. And the Russia collusion
narrative, which someone tweeted out, Biden, you know, a Biden photograph when he accepted or was crowned president-elect by the media. It was an uplifting photograph, you know. And when Trump, there was a Time magazine cover showing the Kremlin overshadowing the White House, like sitting athwart on top of it. The Kremlin sitting on top of the White House with Trump's name. And I've always wondered, if it were me, and I've learned this from working in Chicago, and our old editor, Jim Squires, we got a story that Harold Washington had been surreptitiously taped talking about Dorothy Tillman and calling her all sorts of names. And this story came to us and the Tribune, and I was assigned, along with Mark Eisman and others, Bruce was part of it, and Marie Lipinski, I think, all of us, we were young reporters. We had to go out and walk the cat back. How did this story get to us? What was it about? Who was playing pulling the lever?
Right.
And many of us, including me, I was horrified. I was like, you know, Mr. Squires, I was afraid to even talk to him because he'd scream at you, you know, like in that Tennessee twang of his. But it taught me an important lesson. He said, if we get used, our readers get used, if we lose our credibility, we have nothing. And I've never forgotten that, you know, in terms of dealing with anonymous sources. So the point being, John, that this Russia thing was never walked back. There were Pulitzer Prizes awarded to the New York Times and the Washington Post on a story that turned out not to be true.
You know, I this is one where there are exceptions that prove this rule, John. I'm going to talk about two people whom I don't know. I have no connection to. The Washington Post has a media writer named Eric Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E, who did a series of about 10 columns. Was it earlier this year or did he start late last year on sort of going through the miserable performance of the American media through that story? And that's just one of the most courageous things I've ever seen anybody, you know, do who types for a living. It's names, it's dates, it's here's what the story said, here's why the story was wrong, here's what the reporter has to say about it now.
I thought that was valuable, very valuable. But
it was fabulous.
But, I mean, like, Dean Baquet, I worked with him, I think you did too. We were kid reporters together chasing corruption, now runs the New York Times. I want to see their news writers walk that cat back. You know, I don't want John Brennan's scalp or Howard, or what's his name, Schiff, Adam Schiff's scalp, although I would love it on a stick outside my lodge. But I really don't want their scalp as much as I want the news organizations to acknowledge how they had been manipulated by insiders to the point where it affected our politics and our republic. And I don't see that happening.
I agree with you, but I think we just have to get accustomed to that. Never, that is not going to occur. There are careers at stake. There are corporate fortunes at stake. It's the notion of, the New York Times has done this. It has acknowledged that Walter Duranty, a reporter not quite a century ago, got mesmerized by
Stalin.
Russia.
Stalin, right? A few
yeah. And
in order to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs, right?
And became essentially a public relations tool for Stalin. I mean, now I need to catch myself here. I'm not drawing equivalencies between Walter Duranty, Stalin, and any stories we've read in the last couple of years. They're not equivalencies. But there is this simple notion. I mean, if Eric Wimple can feel that he can go into the Post newsroom where people wrote some of those stories and that he can tell the truth, how come? I mean, by contrast, there's a story in the New Yorker currently about the war for the New York Times, the Civil War, where you have it's an excellent article. It's in New York. I said New Yorker, and I'm wrong. It's in New York Magazine, not the New Yorker. New York Magazine, and it talks about the war between the institutionalists who want to protect the Times' reputation and the insurrectionists who are more interested in the cause than they are in the news organization that employs them. And I would recommend anybody who's interested in this topic to take a look at the story in New York Magazine about the New York Times. It's just fascinating. The story ends, John, with three reporters who are, this is my term, but I'm not, it's my paraphrase. Three reporters who have this problem. They seem to always want to tell the truth. And, you know, that's no matter where the truth leads. And I read the story and how they've basically been put under constant nursing care. The three of them have a top level editor who has to oversee their work because we don't want the rest of the staff getting upset by what they've written. And lo and behold, the day after I read that long story in New York, one of the three, a reporter named Nellie Bowles, and she's the other, I don't know her. She's a young reporter, mostly covers Silicon Valley. She has an excellent story out of Kenosha about the fallacy that it's only property. And when it's okay to loot, riot, and burn, because it's only property. And she does a pretty deep dive into the families whose businesses have been devastated by rioting, looting, burning in Kenosha. And you get to the end and you say, okay, I feel like I understand this now. This reporter told me the truth. I just trust her. So for the rest of my life, I'm going to see the name, the byline Nellie Bowles, and I'm going to believe her.
Question for you, John. Why do we have to wait months after the fact? I'm a son of a small business owner, right? I know what it's like, and so do many people in the newsrooms. You lose your life and your family's future when you lose a business, whether by COVID, you know, and the governor, or by fire and a mob, you know, led by leftist agitators. But why wasn't it immediately understood that way? Why did it have to take months? Because I would suggest it took months because in newsrooms across the country, and I've experienced this myself, there's a woke warrior attitude that certain things are above or not to be mentioned. The things, you know, the you cannot say the name. Don't say George Soros, for God's sakes, or don't think in a certain way. And I what bothers me the most of all of this is that our myth is that we're iconoclasts. The myth of the journalist is that we're iconoclasts. But really, we're in some fashion, what you've been describing is guardians, palace guardians, standing outside the gate of whatever the establishment is to protect it.
I had not thought of it that way.
Tell me if I'm out of line.
There's definitely a crusader instinct, and mm-hmm. and you know this is the distance between crusader and zealot. You know, it's not a long walk from crusader to zealot, and when you get into zealotry, then it's pretty easy to justify decisions you've made, because whatever helps the cause, whatever, you know, it's all justifiable. I clearly readers are onto it. I mean, we would have had a very different conversation 5, 6, 7 years ago, John, because maybe some people saw it, but a lot of people didn't. Now, I mean, I live on a block full of wonderful folks, many of whom are Democrats, otherwise have a pretty liberal view of the world. But I mean, they get it. They understand that the news media is not by and large the reliable, even-handed source that they grew up with. I don't know if it bothers them as much as it might bother you and me, but they get it. They know it. So I there's no artifice here. And you know, every time someone cancels, be it a print publication or cancels a digital subscription, they're telling us something. We failed them.
If you look at broadcast, and maybe that'll get Jeff off the dime. You know,
we got to light Jeff up here.
Light Jeff up. If you look at broadcast, you know, or like I would say, narrowcast, you have, you know, your David Axelrod's on CNN, and you have the conservatives on the right on Fox. Or I guess now Fox is also having its problems with the right, based on how, you know, they called Arizona and not called it, et cetera. We become, is there any space for what Tom Bevin has been talking about, you know, news operations that are less partisan on the broadcast side?
Is there space for less partisanship? I mean,
yeah.
We have to define it as two different things, though, because there's broadcast is almost narrowcasting in a sense now that people get so much of their information or what they perceive as information from the internet, from sources online and digital. And I know that, you know, every paper and every TV station, you know, feeds into that. But the majority of what people receive and think about in the general en masse is unfiltered. It's something that they're getting from, they don't know where, or they from someone else, from a friend of a friend, or they find it and they take it as fact. And I don't know that, and John, you and I have talked about this, is that I don't know that the idea of not being able to echo someone else's perception of reality that falls in line with your perception is of interest to people. People want to be reinforced in their belief or their understanding of what the reality is. And I don't think there is a desire among the masses to find the other side, to find what might not be what they believe or what might not be what they perceive. And I think that battle is just already gone, and it was lost years ago.
John?
Wow, that's a sobering that's a sobering conclusion, and there's no reason whatsoever to doubt it.
I guess you could ask Twitter and Facebook whether we can share views they might not accept.
But Jeff's telling us something, you know, that for which we need another half hour someday, John. The notion that when I turn on the news or when I turn to read the news, that really what I want is a mirror. You've used that term, you know, that like I want to be, and Jeff used the verb reinforced, that I want my own views reinforced. Well, that's kind of a pathetic comment on me, isn't it? That
But isn't that the market? So, okay, I'll give you an example. Trump made his comments about Proud Boys, right? He said something like "stand down" or "stand by" or something in a debate, mm-hmm. and I ripped him for it, right? Mm-hmm. Ripped him for it in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I've been waiting to, and of course, immediately on social media, I'm called that liberal. You know, that son of a bleep liberal Cass, et cetera, which you from Twitter. Mm-hmm. But what I'm most concerned about is not what I said, but that I don't see that same attitude brought by many on the other side, except perhaps Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi, who've written extensively about what you've talked about. I wonder where's their place.
We circle back to, you know, but you know, John, we work with folks at the Tribune. I mean, I am no longer on the Tribune's payroll, so but I'll never let go. So I'm going to keep saying, you know, we work with people who have, you know, liberal outlooks, who are also truth tellers.
Yes.
Here in Chicago, there are, you know, columnists who play that role well. But this really is a job. This really is about editors and, you know, the people who run publications, the people who manage newscasts. It's that person's job to see that what's going out is, you know, at minimum fair and you know, is as accurate as we can make it. I don't blame columnists who try to push the envelope, try to get away with whatever they can. That's kind of human nature. But, you know, editors don't get to just sort of lean back and nod and cross their hands over their tummies and say, you know, well, I'm running a marketplace of ideas. It better be a free marketplace of ideas with lots of different ideas.
It's one of the reasons why, even today, there are two people that I call when I have a question. One is Charles Lipton, and another is John McCormick, when I wonder how to proceed. And I always get the straight answer. I don't get maybe the answer I want on deadline, and I'm panicking. But I do get a thoughtful response and questions. John McCormick, longtime editor of the Chicago Tribune's editorial page. The son of Iowa.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for being here on the Chicago Way, John.
Let me do this again. It's fun to play. Let me do it again.
Definitely.
All right, buddy.
Coach.
All right. See
you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
For John McCormick, my friend and the former editor of the Chicago Tribune's editorial page. For Jeff Carlin, newlywed executive producer at WGN AM Radio. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist, member of the editorial board, on a November day, thinking about the future of journalism and whether we really want a mirror reflecting our own prejudices or a window we can see the world. Join us again, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.